This is Vermont Edition. I'm Nina Keck in for Jane Lindholm. And today we're broadcasting from VPR studios at PEG TV in Rutland. Children born outside the United States are almost half as likely as American kids to suffer from allergic diseases like asthma, eczema, hay fever, and food allergies. And while only 2% of adults in the United States have a food allergy, 8% of kids do. Allergies of all types are on the rise, and today we'll talk about why that is, how allergies are related, and what doctors are doing to diagnose and treat them. My guests are Dr. Betsy Jaffe. She's a clinician at Timberlane Allergy and Asthma Associates, as well as a clinical associate professor in the Department of Pediatrics at the University of Vermont. And Dr. Kay Hellinger. She's a physician who specializes in allergies and immunology at Dartmouth Hitchcock Clinic. She's also an assistant professor of medicine at Dartmouth Medical School. Dr. Jaffe and Dr. Hellinger, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Listeners, do you suffer from allergies? Have you found ways to deal with them? Or are you still wondering what's causing your skin to itch or your nose to run? You can join our conversation by calling 1-800-639-2211, or you can visit our Facebook page and post a comment or a question there. Recent studies are pointing to an increase in allergies in the United States, especially with kids. Dr. Jaffe, what kind of an increase are you seeing in your pediatric practice?
Well, the statistics are pretty impressive. In 1970, allergic rhinitis affected about 10% of individuals, and now that's up to 30%. We've seen a rise in the incidence of food allergy, eczema, asthma, and allergic rhinitis.
And allergic rhinitis, is that when you've got the itchy nose, the runny nose, the weeping eyes?
It encompasses all of that, and nasal congestion.
Well, I was shocked by the statistics showing that kids outside the U.S. Are almost half as likely to suffer from allergic diseases than kids here. Why is that? And what's the tie-in I keep reading about to dirt and sanitation?
Well, it's pretty interesting that the highest incidence of allergic diseases in first world countries, increased sanitation may have predisposed to a type of immune cell that is more likely to lead to allergic disease. And there are some very interesting studies looking, for example, at homes in Africa where pigs are in the home having less incidence of allergic disease, and also a study looking at the reunification of East and West Germany 4 years after the reunification. The allergic rhinitis rate increased fourfold in East Germany,
wow.
And there was quite increased sanitation in that time.
Dr. Hellinger, are you also seeing a rise among your adult patients with diseases like asthma, hay fever, and food allergies?
Yes, I am. And I agree with my colleague, Dr. Jaffe, that in the developed countries such as ours, there is definitely increasing incidence of this, and I think it's partially due to the hygiene hypothesis, where perhaps we live in a little bit too clean an environment. Our immune systems need some exposure as we're growing up to germs and to foreign substances and even dirt, which, of course, in our environment is considered something that we shouldn't have in our homes. But as Dr. Jaffe was saying, in other countries that are less developed, where people are exposed to various infections that our population is not, and more unsanitary conditions, that this has sort of sabotaged the immune system, so to speak, and that the immune system is now recognizing foreign substances like pollen and foods and even insect venoms, and that individuals are now reacting to those substances. And we're seeing a great increase over the last two or three decades.
And is there any pushback? Because it seems to me the last 5 or 10 years, the commercials on television for antibacterial this and antibacterial that and all of the soaps and everything that we're using, are you getting a sense that this idea of the increase in allergies, is that gaining traction? And do you think there's going to be a little bit of a pushback?
I certainly agree with hand washing and general principles of cleanliness. I would say that one thing I think that has propelled this increase is that the use of antibiotics has greatly increased in the past 20, 30, 40 years. And that, too, may be changing our body flora, that meaning the microorganisms that normally should inhabit our bodies. And so, therefore, what's happening is that this is, again, leading to a resetting of the immune system, and that we are now not as resistant to certain foreign substances. So, short answer, clean your hands, wash your hands, but I think that the shift toward using antibiotics very, very frequently, perhaps in many cases not indicated, has also led to this phenomenon.
Interesting. Dr. Jaffe, are there any differences between how men and women or young boys and young girls are affected by allergies?
There is an increased incidence in asthma in young boys versus young girls, but then in adulthood, females are more likely to have increased asthma. So there is a bit of a flip, and there are definitely hormonal influences on asthma and allergies. For example, in pregnancy, asthma, a third of people with asthma will get worse, a third get better, a third stay the same. Nobody really knows why someone falls into those thirds. But there can be hormonal influences on allergic disease.
Interesting. 1-800-639-2211, the number to call if you'd like to join our discussion on allergies today. Again, that's 1-800-639-2211, or you can visit the Vermont Edition site on VPR's website. That's vpr.net. Let's take a call now from Fayston. Judy is on the line. Hi, Judy. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane and everybody. I'm very glad to hear this this subject. And I thoroughly agree with the use of what's the word I want?
Histamine? Did you say antihistamine?
The ones that people always use creams and things so they don't get any germs.
Oh, antibacterial?
Thank you, yes, antibacterial. It does. You can't build up a resistance. And I also want to mention that so many people think goldenrod is one of the things, major causes of allergies, and it's not, because the pollen is too heavy to be carried by the wind. But dealing with asthma, I have had it three times in my life. Every single time I had it was after a major stressful event. In my early 20s, I had it very badly, and there was a good reason for it. And I got on the ship for Europe and left the asthma on shore. And I so believe that stress is a major cause of asthma, and I think a lot of people don't realize that. I've told a few people that, and they say, oh, well, I never do that.
Yeah. Let me pick it up. That's an interesting point. Dr. Hillinger, is there any connection with stress and things like asthma?
Absolutely. Stress is one of the triggers for asthma, and of course there are many others. But it's true that if a person is in an increasingly stressful or anxiety-provoking situation, that can cause them to have increasing symptoms of asthma. And, of course, part of life is stress, unfortunately. We all have to deal with that, and yet major stress can certainly aggravate it, just as major stress can aggravate many, many medical conditions. So it's important to try to implement measures to reduce stress in your life as best you can and learn how to cope with it. But it's absolutely true that stress is a trigger.
Well, according to some recent information from the state health department, 11% of Vermont adults currently have asthma, which is higher than the U.S. average of 8.6%. Any idea, Dr. Hillinger, why asthma would be more prevalent here?
Well, that's a very interesting question, and I'm afraid that I really don't have a pat answer for it. One comment, though, I would make is that there is an increasing incidence as well as diagnosing of asthma and other allergic conditions. And it takes an astute clinician to pick up on a person with asthma and pick up on their symptoms and route them to the proper specialist. So I think that perhaps the incidence may be due to the expertness of our local physicians, and also, a 3% increase over 8% is significant. However, I would say that I don't think it's due to the fact that perhaps Vermonters have any cleaner houses than anyone else in this country, because I don't think that could account for it. But I would say that there's a higher incidence of people being diagnosed. Other than that, perhaps there are fewer smokers in the state of Vermont. That can certainly lead to aggravation of asthma. And so
well,
that
we also
could be
have a lot of
factor.
We also have a lot of wood-burning stoves in mm-hmm. Vermont. Dr. Jaffe, do you see any reasons behind why Vermonters may have a higher incidence?
You know, it's many of the New England states, actually, that have a higher incidence. Vermont seems to have the highest by the statistics that were recently gathered. But we have 80% of homes in Vermont have furred animals. That's 20% higher than the nation in general. We love our animals. So people who are allergic, that's definitely a trigger for asthma. And also in the New England states, it's cold. We spend a lot of time inside. Wood-burning stoves, indoor smoke exposure can certainly have an effect on that. But there is a Vermont state asthma plan to study some of these factors that's come out in the last should be implemented over the next 5 years. So we might have some better answers down the road.
And Dr. Jaffe, how's the way asthma is treated changed over the last few years? Has it changed?
It used to be thought of as bronchoconstriction, and people would use bronchodilators like albuterol over and over. And in the last several decades, there's been recognition that it's an inflammatory disease and more of a movement towards using inhaled steroids to reduce that inflammation. There have been some very good asthma guidelines that have come out that have steps of care depending upon the severity of the asthma. Unfortunately, the document is a 450-page long document. It can be summarized in two sentences, I think, which is that you need a controller medication such as an inhaled steroid if you need albuterol more than twice a week, or you're waking from sleep more than twice a month, or colds settle in the chest lasting more than 10 days, and that happens less than 6 weeks apart. That's the down and dirty of 450 pages.
Wow. Way to synopsize it. Listeners, if you're just joining us, we're talking about allergies, why more Americans seem to have them, how doctors are diagnosing them, and what some of the best ways to treat their symptoms are. My guests are Dr. Kay Hillinger. She's a physician who specializes in allergies and immunology at Dartmouth-Hitchcock Clinic, and Dr. Betsy Jaffe. She's a clinician at Timberlane Allergy and Asthma Associates. Let's take a few callers here. Let's go to Rutland now and talk with Kate. Hi, Kate. Welcome to Vermont Edition.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
I just wanted to bring up the American Lung Association has said that one in four individuals is sensitive to ground-level ozone. And one of the things that's different about the New England states is they have to have worse air quality, because we're on the receiving end of air quality starting in Nebraska with coal-burning power plants, and also particularly in Vermont and in Rutland in particular, coming from New York City. So what happens, I believe, the Lung Association says, is because you're kind of chronically sunburned on your mucous membranes, you're much more prone to allergic rhinitis and asthma. And I know myself, as a sufferer, that when I spend time in areas where there is not significant ground level ozone, I do not need asthma medication. I'd like to hear your comments on that.
Yeah, thanks for that call. Dr. Hillinger, what have you heard about the connection with ozone that Kate just brought up? Anything?
Yes, she's right about that. The Lung Association has put that forward, and so ozone can be a trigger for asthma, in addition to many, many other substances in the air, such as smoke of any kind, pollution, obviously, and the list goes on and on. So, but yes, that has been reported, and so it's a lot of asthma is actually not allergic. And that's something I think that many people don't realize. Many of my patients, and I see older teenagers and adults, have asthma but no allergies whatsoever. And so they don't have to be allergic to a cat or dust or pollen to have asthma. And lots of these respiratory irritants like ozone or smoke or pollution or strong odors such as perfume, incense, anything like that can trigger an asthmatic reaction. So these sorts of irritants are not allergens. There's a difference in an allergy and an irritant. So an irritant would be something like tobacco smoke. An allergy would be such as a cat dander allergy. And so it's very, very important to avoid those particular triggers.
Dr. Jeffy, I want to ask you one more follow-up question just about the state's new asthma plan. What does that plan entail? Are there any big new changes that you're going to be making?
The asthma plan is a global plan to decrease the burden of asthma statewide. So to recognize the diagnosis and to get people at times, for example, when they're in the emergency room, and educate them about asthma rather than just sending them out on prednisone and not putting them on a controller medication. We've come up with an emergency plan for asthma discharge that we hope will help get people at a point of care when they're most susceptible to thinking about this. So it's a global plan with many different things, trying to improve air quality, trying to educate people about what type of medications they should be using, and trying to help providers educate themselves and their patients more about how to take care of their health. So our ER plan that's in the works now is called MAPLE. Because it's Vermont, and it stands for most important, telling people that they should not have been in the ER in the first place, and if they are, that they're exposed to some triggers that are increasing their asthma. A is for asthma, talking about the asthma as a chronic inflammatory disease. P, a plan for the kinds of medications that people should be using. And L, learning about triggers. And how to take inhalers, and E, when you need emergency care. So we will be sending that out to emergency rooms and then be tracking how this affects emergency room incidents of people going to the emergency room and how many people are being hospitalized. There's certain particular target areas that we're looking at. So these outcomes will be tracked over the next 5 years.
Great. And listeners, you can join our conversation at 1-800-639-2211. Maybe you've had some luck in treating your own allergies and you'd like to share that. Again, our number is 1-800-639-2211. You can also post a comment or a question at vpr.net/Vermont Edition. And we'll talk more about asthma and hay fever and food allergies after a short break. This is Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Nina Keck in for Jan Lindholm, and we're broadcasting today from VPR Studios in Rutland at PEG TV. We're talking about allergies, who gets them, and why they're on the rise. My guests are Dr. Kay Hillinger, a physician who specializes in allergies and immunologies. She's also an assistant professor of medicine at Dartmouth Medical School, and Dr. Betsy Jaffe. She's a clinician at Timberlane Allergy and Asthma Associates, and she also teaches medicine in the Department of Pediatrics at the University of Vermont. Katya writes in on email. She says, I was wondering about any information you could provide about oral allergy syndrome. I've been suffering from this for years. Eating many types of raw vegetables and fruits results in swelling of my lips and tongue. I would love to find out where I can find out more info about oral allergy syndrome and how to cope with it. Dr. Hillinger, what would you suggest Katya do?
Well, oral allergy syndrome is actually a fairly common condition, and it occurs because of biochemical similarity between certain plant pollens to which a person is allergic, such as tree or grass pollen, and foods and which are biochemically similar to the plant pollens. So I'll give you an example of oral allergy syndrome. A person who's allergic to birch tree pollen may note swelling or itching of the mouth and lips and even throat when they ingest apples. Now, if the apples are cooked in a pie, they can typically eat those because the the protein in the fruit is actually denatured by cooking or by heating. Now, the symptoms are typically itching of the lips, the mouth, the throat, and so we see this very, very frequently. Particularly, I've been struck by the high numbers of patients I've seen with this condition. I previously practiced in the South, and because of the different plants there, different grasses and trees, I didn't see this as frequently as I have in this area. So it's very, very common in children and adults, and it's not unusual for a person actually to eat a food for decades and then suddenly find that when they eat something, a fresh food or vegetable, that their mouth and lips and throat begin to get itchy and even a bit swollen. So that's basically what occurs when a person has this condition. It's a matter of avoiding the food, basically, or cooking it. And it's a little bit different from the other end of the spectrum as far as food allergy, as opposed to, say, anaphylaxis to shellfish or that sort of situation where often the patient lands in the emergency room.
No, I was just going to say, let me jump to another email here because it kind of ties that in as well in a way. I have asthma. This is Jeanette who wrote on our Facebook page. I have asthma and a shellfish allergy that causes my throat to close if I eat even a small trace of shellfish. After allergy tests, my doctor informed me that I am more allergic to birch trees than I am to shellfish. I'm thinking that's where my seasonal allergies come from. She says, I try to eat local honey. We cut down all the birch trees on our 5 acres, and both those things seem to help. She doesn't mention the oral allergy syndrome, but the birch trees mm-hmm. that you mentioned. And she also mentions eating honey, which I've read on a number of websites, people bring up eating honey a lot in treatment for allergies. And mm-hmm. I'm wondering, are there any scientific studies that support that or what your thoughts are? I'd like to ask both of mm-hmm. you, but Dr. Hillinger, why don't I start with you on that?
Sure. I've had a few patients report to me that their allergy symptoms seem to improve when they ingest honey. I can't explain the scientific basis for that. I don't feel that it's harmful, but I don't know the specific reason for that. But let me make a comment on as far as what this individual said about, first of all, cutting down birch trees on the property. That's absolutely not necessary because birch tree pollen is floating around in the air for miles and miles around. And just because you cut down 50 birch trees doesn't mean that you're going to avoid birch tree pollen. But she also has, you mentioned, a shellfish allergy. So that's something that requires complete avoidance. That's a different situation, really, from oral allergy syndrome.
Right. It's interesting, all of these different sort of levels. You've got the asthma that might not even be an allergy. You've got eating shellfish, mm-hmm. and it can be very dangerous for somebody. Someone right. touching mango or another, you know, kiwi right. on their lips and feeling the tingling. Dr. Right. Jaffe, I'd like to get your take on the honey and other sorts of home remedies that you've heard about. What your take are on those methods of treatment?
Well, I've actually had some patients have anaphylaxis from trying to eat raw honey that had pollens in it. If you are severely pollen allergic and you're ingesting the pollens, it could be an issue. So I don't recommend that. I mean, for oral allergy syndrome, I actually have it myself. It's an uncomfortable feeling. It rarely leads to anaphylaxis. And as Dr. Hillinger mentioned, if you cook cook the foods, it's not a problem. Immunotherapy, which might be kind of the same idea that what they're trying to get at with these small amounts of pollen in the honey, immunotherapy for those pollens can be very helpful for oral allergy syndrome. So, for example, if you can't eat raw apples but you desensitize to birch pollen by doing allergy shots, you may be able to eat raw apples. It's not the major motivation that people generally have, but sometimes oral allergy is quite debilitating in terms of the numbers of foods that people can't eat. Birch cross-reacts with a whole bunch of things. Apples and almost all pitted fruits, snap peas, figs, they're a variety.
Dr. Jaffe, I want to ask you a little bit. When you have patients come in, kids come in, and you know there's some sort of an allergy or the parents think there's some sort of an allergy, talk about the detective work that you need to do to figure out what exactly is causing the reaction.
For a food allergy or?
Yeah, let's start with food allergies.
Okay. an interesting example that sort of crosses over was a patient I had who had taken a horse ride and was eating a peanut butter sandwich and developed swelling and breathing difficulties, and thought that they were peanut allergic. Our peanut test was negative. The horse was very strongly positive. The anaphylaxis was from the horse and not from the peanut. Huh. So the history is very important, getting all the details, what was going on. When it's a food allergy, generally the symptoms will be within 2 hours of eating the food. Once you become allergic, it happens each time you eat a substantial portion of that food, and usually doesn't take much at all. The symptoms generally resolve within 4 hours of treatment. So it's not that you're going to eat the food and the next day feel badly. It's generally right within that two-hour time frame.
Interesting. But yet, you know, and the obvious thing you'd think of that would be the peanut butter sandwich. And do you find that patients come in and they think it's one thing and then you find, you know, no, it's the birch bark or something like that? Is that a pretty common thing?
It's pretty common to come up with something different than what they think it is.
All right. Well, let's take a few more phone calls while we can. Let's go to Whiting and talk with Roger. Hi, Roger. Go ahead.
Yeah, hi. I don't know if you addressed it before, but I was wondering, I've been able to eat shrimp all my life, never a problem. And then recently, if the shrimp isn't absolutely fresh, then all of it, like over the evening, my throat will close up in the morning. Is there any kind of, is that some sort of allergy I've developed to this shellfish, or is that even considered shellfish?
Well, let's throw that to Dr. Hillinger.
Yes, a shrimp is definitely a shellfish. It's a crustacean. Shellfish are divided into mollusks and crustaceans. And so it's not uncommon to have been able to eat shrimp your whole life, and then suddenly you eat it one day and you have throat swelling and tightness, and which is a very obviously dangerous situation. And so this is because your immune system has been exposed to shrimp many times over the years and has recognized it now as a foreign and has produced antibodies against this food. So it should for sure be avoided indefinitely, forever. And you should have an EpiPen, which is an epinephrine auto-injector device, which is a life-saving device to have on hand. And anyone with a severe food allergy should carry that at all times, know how to use it. Family members should know how to use it, and then the individual should proceed to the emergency room if it is utilized.
All right, Roger, thanks for that call. I'm noticing, seeing more and more about folks that suffer from lactose intolerance and especially glucose intolerance. We're seeing a lot more of that. Are those conditions a type of food allergy, or are they something completely different? Dr. Jaffe.
That's a food intolerance. So lactose intolerance is the loss of an enzyme that breaks down the sugar, lactose. And this generally occurs with time. It's unusual in the first couple years of life. It's generally in older individuals. And it gives them gas and bloating, some diarrhea, stomach pain. But it's different than a food protein allergy, the IgE-mediated allergies that can give anaphylaxis.
All right. And I have one more. Let me read another comment here. Denise wrote in. She says, I'm curious if allergies or asthma can cause a person to lose the sense of smell and taste. After a bout with the flu, over Easter, I lost both of these senses. My doctor felt it was due to allergies and prescribed steroids. However, I've not yet regained either of my senses, the smell or taste. Any thoughts on if this can be attributed to either allergies or asthma? Dr. Hillinger.
What I would say about that is that loss of smell and taste is actually not an uncommon symptom for individuals who have sinus disease or severe allergic rhinitis, meaning nasal symptoms, congestion, sneezing, postnasal drip. This can sometimes occur after an acute respiratory infection, typically upper respiratory, and may take a while to resolve. Typically, oral steroids such as prednisone will speed the resolution of this condition, but it's important to consider that after an upper respiratory infection, if upper respiratory symptoms persist over a long period of time, that this individual should be evaluated for chronic sinus disease, which can definitely lessen the sense of smell and taste. And another thing is that nasal polyps are sometimes seen in people with rhinitis and asthma, and that needs to be evaluated for as well.
I want to ask you briefly before we wrap up, some researchers believe that putting off the introduction of certain foods, when we talk about food allergies like eggs or peanuts, sometimes parents are told to put those foods off. Briefly, Dr. Jaffe, you know, is that a good thing to do, or should parents give those foods right from the get-go?
Well, that advice is changing now. The latest recommendations are introduce the foods early. So one of the reasons that food allergy has been on the rise, perhaps, is that we've been telling people to introduce the foods later, and because we thought with an immature immune system this would be a problem. However, it seems like that does not give the chance to develop tolerance early on. So introducing early is better.
All right. Well, lots to think about. Obviously, by the amount of comments and calls we received today, allergies are something a lot of people are thinking about. Listeners, you can keep the discussion going on our website, vpr.net/Vermont Edition. Dr. Kay Hillinger, a physician who specializes in allergies and immunology, and Dr. Betsy Jaffe is a clinician at Timberlane Allergy and Asthma Associates. She also teaches medicine at the University of Vermont. Dr. Jaffe and Dr. Hillinger, thank you so much for talking with us today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Nina Keck. This coming weekend, some of the country's top mountain bikers will descend on the Catamount Outdoor Center in Williston for one of the most important races of the year, the National Finals in the Top Circuit. It's in the Pro XCT Mountain Bike Series. Racing for the title is Vermont cyclist and Olympian Leah Davison. She and her sister Sabra have also been very involved in organizing this race and in trying to make sure that women are treated as fairly as the male racers, something that doesn't often happen in professional cycling. Vermont Edition's Jane Lindholm spoke with the Davison sisters about the race.
This is a big deal because this is the national final. You know, we've accrued points over the season, and this is for the title, you know, for 2013. So I'll be nervous. But, yeah, the energy's high. There's a lot of people. There's a lot of cheering. And, yeah, everyone's just excited for you to put on a good show.
And for spectators, what can they see? I mean, can they run to different parts of the course and see different pieces of it?
Yeah, exactly. It's on a 5K loop on the hillside at Catamount. So it's very spectator friendly. And there's these big features in the course. They're called A lines and B lines. And the A lines are more challenging. And we have a series of jumps, actually. So there's three main sections, three main A lines, and they're in very good spectator places. Yeah.
Sabra, you're one of the race directors for this race.
I am. Eric Valker and I are working together on this huge event.
So do you set up the course? How does that work?
So he is on course setup with other Catamount employees, but they've been designing it throughout the year, actually. So it's been a work in progress, custom made for this event. Mark Stannard's done an amazing job.
How many times have you been on the course?
A lot. We actually just took our 12-year-olds on it today with our Little Bella's camp, and we've tested it a number of times throughout the year. So the locals definitely have a one-up on the people traveling.
And actually, on Sunday, locals can race. There's an amateur race
they
as well.
They can, yeah. They can race the same course as the pros. That's why we put the B lines in.
So, Leah, do the Little Bellas, the camp that you guys run, are they giving you advice on how to race the course?
Definitely. I mean, I'm learning a lot from them. They'll show me some lines out there and how to hit the A lines, I'm sure, how to hit the jumps.
Now, normally in a race course, or often in races, the women race first and the men race second in the afternoon when there are the most spectators. I suppose also the most chances for sponsorship or people to be seeing it. And the men also get paid more.
And that is a mandate given by the UCI, Union Cycliste Internationale, which is a Swiss governing body that governs all cycling federations throughout the world. So they're setting this standard throughout the world that's more for the men than the women.
And that, when you call it a mandate, I mean, it sounds like people aren't even allowed to give the women more. Is that the case?
You are allowed to give more than the prize money mandate. So those are the minimums. So we have to meet the mandate. and for both men and women. And we decided that we were going to meet and surpass for the women, most definitely.
So what is the prize money at the event?
It's actually we're flipping it on its head. So the women are going to make 40% more than the men. We think maybe for the first time in the history of mountain bike racing. So the women are actually going to get more than the men for prize money. And yeah, we're going to set a good example for the Little Bellas, you know, because here we're going to hold our Little Bellas camp. It's for young girls, teaching them how to mountain bike. And some of them may want to become mountain bike racers. So how could we set this example of, hey, in subtle ways, you know, the women race before the men in the less premier time slot, they make less money. How can we set that as an example and encourage girls to get into this sport when they start out on an unequal footing? So, yeah, we're very excited about this opportunity to say, hey, look, there's hope in the future, and we're pushing for that equality.
So for an event like this, what is the purse for the first place finisher?
It's about $400, yeah.
So it's still, it's a small amount. I mean, you're not going to go, this isn't going to make your season on this one event. So is it mostly symbolic, do you think?
It is, yeah. We wish we could do more. And as a first year event, that's actually pretty good. But in the future, I hope that this standard resonates, and it has. So at the cyclocross race at Catamount, someone already stepped up to equal the prize money, and that's not even till the fall. So we are seeing a trickle-down effect throughout our races and throughout cycling.
What kind of responses have you heard from the men on the circuit or from the UCI?
Well, it was interesting. We did a video out at Sea Otter Classic, which is the first Pro XCT of the series. And we interviewed one of the race team managers for Team Luna. It's an all-women's team. And he's this Polish guy. And he said, well, guys, you're just going to have to suck it up. And so it was very funny to get that perspective of someone that runs these teams, because he just said women are more marketable. And so whether the reaction is good or not, mostly it has been positive. But it's interesting that within a women-specific team, that was there. So,
and any word from the UCI? I mean, do you think this has reached them in any way?
I think it's reached them. There has been no pushback or feedback either way. I think because we're simply meeting their rules and we're within their guidelines, so they're okay with that, which is great. I think it's interesting when you look at sport and where money in sport is. It says a lot about the nature of it, and so when sponsors come in and support something or when sponsors don't, it really says a lot. And that sponsors are stepping up and supporting this, I think that really shows that the general public is behind a movement like this.
Leah, do you make your income mostly from these events or sponsorship, or how do you piece it all together?
Yeah, it's, you know, the prize money at these events is more of a bonus, and obviously $400, you know, if you're winning, it's not going to pay the bills. So I make a living from Specialized. I'm a Specialized factory racer, but the thing with that is, you know, I'm probably in the top 5% of the female mountain bikers, and there's only a handful of us that make salaries in the U.S., professional mountain bike racing. So where prize money can step in is if it's equal, if there are bigger prize purses, then more women can actually earn a living doing this sport and not only earn a living, but actually get to the races. So in the future, that's, you know, if we're lucky enough to have this race again, I would like to see, you know, maybe the Women's Sports Foundation or find other creative ways to get a pool of money together to cover travel expenses, to get the pro women to these races, because it's very expensive. You know, it's expensive to fly alone, and then fly with a bike is even more expensive. So I think that's the potential to grow the sport.
And what are you most looking forward to this weekend? You both have different roles. You both have, you know, things that are probably making you nervous as you look ahead. So is just the end what you're most looking forward to?
I'm actually really excited about our camp because these girls have the opportunity to meet world champions. They have amazing men and women racing in their backyard. And a lot of the Little Bellas families are actually host families for the pros. We use that as a way to get more pros that aren't being paid huge salaries here. So they get to stay with their idols, which is very unique. And we will be hosting a Meet the Pros event on Friday at Breakwaters. So we're really trying to make these amazing, incredible athletes accessible to the community at large.
And Leah?
I'm excited for the entire thing. I mean, we've been thrilled about this opportunity to actually do something. So we've been fighting this fight for a while, you know, just creating the Little Bellas, giving more women opportunities to fall in love with cycling, and it's really happening. I mean, we could make a statement with this event, and we're doing it. So I'm just excited for all the pieces to come together and hopefully to have a great race and hopefully to get a lot of great photos and video footage so we can really spread the message further than just the audience and the spectators that just come on the day.
Well, Leah and Sabra Davison, good luck to both of you, and thanks for talking with me.
Thank you so much.
The Pro XCT Mountain Bike Series National Finals are going on this weekend at the Catamount Outdoor Family Center in Williston, and we have a link at vpr.net. This summer, the Shelburne Museum has created an exhibit of paintings by the three generations of the Wyeth family, N.C. Wyeth, Andrew Wyeth, and Jamie Wyeth. The Wyeths have enjoyed a popular following, but critics have been tougher on their body of work. Tom Denenberg is the executive director of the Shelburne Museum and curator of the Wyeth exhibit. He says all three generations of Wyeths have produced work that is more substantial and often darker than it appears at first glance. The exhibit of their work is called Wyeth Vertigo, and Denenberg recently walked us through it.
Vertigo is the key to understanding the Wyeths. All three generations of Wyeths, N.C. Wyeth, Andrew Wyeth, and Jamie Wyeth, like to knock you off your pins a little bit to make you dizzy, and they do this by employing unusual perspective, extreme perspective, in their paintings, paintings that look up, look down, in and out of odd spaces. We're standing in front of Andrew Wyeth's masterpiece, Soaring. It's a monumental, large-scale painting of three turkey buzzards encircling a little Pennsylvania farmhouse near his home in Chatsford. You are absolutely up there, and the question that the painting begs is, you know, are you another bird? You know, how can you get this perspective? Are you in an airplane? And that's something that really runs throughout this exhibition. You have a very hard time placing yourself in the picture as a visitor. This painting is also really a Cold War narrative. Between 1943, let's say, and when this painting is actually exhibited in 1950 for the first time, that kind of imagery has a very, very different meaning. The world over has been watching newsreels from World War II after 1945, of course. We're used to duck and cover under our school desks. So the sort of the dive bomber-like image of the painting is also something that Wyeth well and truly understood as he produced it. The other thing, of course, is these are scavengers. So the implication immediately is, something is wrong on the ground. Something is dead on the ground if these animals are circling that farm. The fascinating thing about the Wyeths is, for the last 75 years or so, they have achieved tremendous popular acclaim, but they've never received critical respect. And in fact, in the 1940s and 50s, Andrew Wyeth was really the painter the critics loved to hate. Critics found him, too easy. You know, the narrative is right there in front of you. But I think what everyone has missed over the years is just how profoundly strange they are. And that's a, you know, a term of great honor in the Wyeth family. But the sort of the darkness and the vertiginous, the sort of dizzying quality, which all three of them exhibit, really makes a very interesting lens through which to see this dynasty of American painters.
That's Tom Denenberg, executive director of the Shelburne Museum. He curated the exhibit Wyeth Vertigo, which presents paintings by three generations of the Wyeth family. That exhibit is open through October. And that's Vermont Edition for today. Tomorrow, Bob Kinzel's guest will be Senator Patrick Leahy. The senator is holding hearings on the Patriot Act to look at oversight of surveillance programs and limitations on the government's ability to read people's emails. We'll look at those topics and more with Senator Patrick Leahy tomorrow on the show. Vermont Edition is produced by Patty Daniels, Rick Singeri, and Sage Van Wing, with production assistance from Tim Johnson and Annie Pruitt. Peter Biello directed the show. Our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. I'm Nina Keck. Thanks for listening.